Awe and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And my guest today is Dr. Hannah Chulik Baird, Assistant Professor of Classical Studies at Boston University. This is episode CXIX, Fragments of Early Roman Literature. While we are lucky that much Roman literature from the late Republic and Imperial period comes down to us complete or almost complete, most of the historical and poetic works from the mid-Republic have been lost and only survive in fragments. In this episode, we discuss some of these nearly lost early Roman texts. Here's Hannah Chulik Baird.
Roman literature is thought to begin in the 3rd century BCE with Livius Andronicus. We often date the beginning of literature because a play is produced in 240 BCE. He also translated the Odyssey into Latin, and so people like to draw attention to the fact that Rome's beginning came from Greece, which is a theme that I'm sure we'll return to. And then we have a subsequent list of playwrights and epic poets. Gnaeus Naevius, who wrote an epic poem on the Punic War. And then in the 2nd century, the really famous poet Quintus Ennius, who wrote the national epic that really precedes the Aeneid, which is called the Annals, which told the story of Rome's history from the very beginning, with Ennius coming to Italy up until the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, up until contemporary with himself.
Right up until his own life.
Right, which is different from Virgil, who never decided to make that recent documentary experience.
That's something we should talk about as well, what's different and what's going on then. So thank you for giving us that grounding in three of the big names from early Roman literature. Right. It's quite a start. Just to fill in the background for people, what do we still have of these authors?
Yes, well, so let's take Ennius is the famous one for many reasons. The connection between Ennius and Virgil is one of those reasons. And also because he was the first to write Latin in the hexameter, getting rid of this Italic meter, the Saturnian, that the previous two had written in for their epics.
So just to ground people there, yes. Hexameter is what Homer writes in,
exactly.
In Greek, of course. And then it's subsequently what becomes the meter of epic.
Yes.
But earlier on, we had this different, can we call it native meter?
That's often the way it is, or Italic, right? Which helps us see that even though it's clear that we can't have had these poets active without Greek predecessors, that's what they gravitated towards. Nonetheless, it always had a deep connection to Italy and Rome. And we would love to have this stuff because it would tell us so much more about how Romans felt about themselves in their earlier time, in their Republican time. But anyway, your question, how much this survives, if we take Ennius, the famous edition by Otto Skutsch has around 400 secure fragments, which can range from reasonably long, kind of 10, 15 lines to one word here or there. These fragments can either be quotations or they can be allusions by subsequent writers. For example, Virgil, Cicero starts his On the Republic with a quotation of Ennius's Dream of Homer. So these are these nice allusions that kind of give us a sense of what was lost, although we have almost nearly what we would want. So Ennius's Annales, by the way, was in its completed form 18 books long.
So could you talk a little bit about why we have lost these poems? Do we know why we've lost them as complete texts? Why do we have Virgil, but we don't have Ennius, who was clearly really important? Is it just because he's earlier, so it's an accident of transmission?
It probably is Virgil's fault, actually.
Damn Virgil.
Damn him. No, we don't really know exactly why. And I mean, it's worth stating that there's so much that we don't have. There's a nice passage in Gerda Lerner, who wrote The Creation of Patriarchy, that I'll quote to you. This is my favorite quote. I use it in my work and also in my class on women. That which succeeded and survived was by that fact of its survival considered superior to that which had vanished and had thus, quote unquote, failed. So the idea that things survive because they're strong, along the lines, in her view, of the Darwinian perspective, is one of the kind of problems that we have to deal with ourselves and our perspective on this world. Varro in the De Lingua Latina writes that there is little that time doesn't distort, much it obliterates completely. So even from the Roman perspective, they knew that there were things about their own past that they weren't quite getting. But that said, so these are poets, the early ones I mentioned were Andronicus and Naevius are kind of 3rd century, Floruit is in the 2nd century, we also have his nephew Pacuvius and Accius, the scholar poet, in the later 2nd century. These poets were definitely read and staged in the 1st century during Cicero's time. So Cicero tells us about going into the theatre to see their plays. So these are revivals. And he quotes them at length himself. And in his letters, he describes other people quoting them. And also a contemporary of his, Varro, in the De Lingua Latina, on the Latin language, quotes a lot of these poems as well, because he's interested in analysing the Latin language. So we know that during this era, the 1st century BCE, they are absolutely popular. And one of the reasons why we can see that they were so popular is, for example, Horace writes about an annoyance in Epistle 2:1 that the older men think that these poems are so great, whereas they're not paying attention to Horace. So we can get these kind of incidental remarks which show you that they were alive and vibrant, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting that we don't necessarily get the impression that new literature for the Romans was necessarily the best. So the most up-to-date, the
Absolutely.
Most fashionable, there might have been on the part of some people and a lot of nostalgia for what we've unfortunately lost.
Yes.
When you started off by saying, I know you were slightly joking, that it's Virgil's fault that we've lost, say, Ennius, it's not that it had been lost by Virgil's time or even shortly afterwards. Do we know exactly when we no longer have Ennius? Or is it a broad scale we have to deal with?
It's a good question. By the time of the Antonine period, with Gellius, we have a lot of references to book culture, so a book of Ennius could be brought down and examined. But then, as we go along, some of the fragments come from the later grammarians, but it's not sometimes clear whether those people have a book copy or of these poets, or whether they're mining Cicero, for example.
Right.
Even Seneca the Younger, when he quotes from Ennius, seems to be reading it through Cicero.
Hmm.
So it's not entirely clear, but the fact that Virgil was so immensely popular seems to have shifted the focus away. When Seneca the Younger refers to Ennius, he talks about how he's gone moldy because no one's reading him anymore.
We shouldn't necessarily think that these poets were inferior just because we've lost them. I loved your quote from Gerda Lerner, yeah. Which is very much a modern perspective. This idea seems quite topical at the moment,
Agreed.
Actually.
Yes.
That if, you know, if you're great, you will be rich, or you will succeed, or you will be still extant in
right.
the case of these poems. From the fragments we have, though, and I realise this is about value judgments to a certain extent, but Horace was in a way stating that value judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And Horace, I guess, as an Augustan poet, is someone we think of as writing quite sophisticated poetry and telling us that he's written quite sophisticated poetry. He seems to be perhaps judging this past poetry as being not as sophisticated. Would you say that's fair?
I think it's fair that he thinks so. The trouble is, this is another issue about modern scholarship, is how much do we take the statements of the ancients at face value? I think that if we want to interpret Horace here, we need to see that he's making a rhetorical statement and to like unravel it a little bit and see what information it gives us about how these poets were received. You know, even if he's being sarcastic, he is referring to an audience that is interested in these poems. And again, these are being performed at the state festivals every year. So it was in the popular consciousness. The few snapshots that we get give a sense, quite a sophisticated view. For example, in Ennius's Annales, he told the story of Ilia's encounter with Mars and her impregnation. The subsequent birth of Romulus and Remus would come from this encounter. This fragment is very famous, and so it's known as Ilia's Dream. It was transmitted to us because of Cicero. He quotes it in his work on divination. And this dream, it shows us about Ilya and her relationship with her father, who in this telling is Aeneas. There's a little bit of a truncating of history there.
Yes.
But we get a father-daughter relationship, which models actually onto what we know about Roman social attitudes to rape, because the invocation of the father immediately after the sexual violence was taken as a legalistic proof of rape. So in addition to the fact that it tells you something about what we know from other places about Roman social values, it's a dream, right? So it's psychological and it's dreamy. Either way, long story short, it gives you kind of a psychological picture, and it demonstrates that this poetry, however archaic it is, has almost modernist turn that you might not expect to be there.
That's really interesting. I want to ask maybe about the looking backwards and looking forwards from the point of view of poetry like Aeneas's. So we talked very briefly about the relationship to Greek culture. I want to talk about that a bit more. And then to think about exactly how it's reused by people like Cicero, how it's contextualized, and indeed where it is that we've got these fragments, because we've got them because people like Cicero quote them.
Right.
So let's think first about the connection which Aeneas himself makes very explicit with Homer. And as you've already mentioned, what we think of as our first Latin poet performed or created a sort of a translation of the Odyssey. I think we know that it wasn't as long as Homer's Odyssey.
Yeah.
It was just one book, I think I'm right.
Yes, we definitely don't think it was as long as the Odyssey.
There is a kind of wonderful connection with Aeneas.
Right.
Do you want to talk about Aeneas and his attitude towards Homer or
yes,
any Greek literature?
Certainly. So the beginning of the Annals, it starts with Aeneas' invocation of Homer. He, Aeneas, is Homer reincarnated via a short stay as a peacock.
See, that sounds, you were talking about the dreamlikeness of the Iliad fragment being modernistic. That in itself, it sounds almost psychedelic.
Absolutely. And then when you look at the wall paintings from Pompeii that show peacocks, you're starting to see like, oh, this has some kind of connection in terms of what the Romans believed peacocks were symbolic of.
You know, I've never thought of that. And the peacock is sacred to Juno as
right.
well.
Precisely, Rhiannon, you're focusing in on what I'm obsessed with, which is there's some kind of connection here, but we can't quite necessarily explain it. Mm. One of the troubles with focusing on the fact that these are modeled on Greek predecessors is that Greek predecessors won't explain this. It's probably problematic to look at it as looking for the Italic substrate, right? But if you're looking for things which are Roman about it, that you can't go to Greece to turn to it. But anyway, so this is a clear thing that Aeneas is doing to say, I'm the Roman Homer, whatever that means. And the taking over of the hexameter is a huge thing for the Roman culture. By doing so, he distancing himself from the Italic language, the song of the fauns in the woods. So Aeneas himself seems to understand that he's making an intervention into some kind of Italic tradition. And to do that is to take Homer. But of course, Homer belongs to the entire Mediterranean by this point, so...
Yes, exactly. When we think now of ancient Greece, we tend to think of classical Athens, but of course Homer is not part of that. He's earlier and he's not from Athens, but he had been adopted by all of these different strands of Greek cultures, and they don't just exist on mainland Greece by any means.
Absolutely.
So we probably shouldn't divorce him off as just Greek, because he has become currency for the whole Mediterranean.
Yes, and Aeneas himself, as with the rest of the early Roman poets, wasn't from Rome. Gellius writes that he's supposed to have three hearts that are Greek and Oscan and Latin. So we should, again, be interested in whatever of his contemporary world he's trying to reflect. But it isn't insignificant that it is turning to Homer that allows him to make his poetic monument.
I really like that idea that we can look for the Italic elements without getting strung up on the idea that we just don't know, because we don't have very much of that earlier. We don't have reference points.
Right.
And I feel like in the past, people have just kind of given up at that point. Yeah. We've got Homer, so it's easy to make those comparisons. So let's do that.
Yes. Well, it's funny because we're comfortable with the fact that Homer was foundational for the Romans later with Aeneas coming to Rome, right? This story exists in Homer. But other characters from the Homeric cycle are important in other places in Italy. Diomedes, for example, is supposed to have been the founder of various parts of Apulia. So if we pay attention to how local civic entities invoke the past, which for them, Homer was historical in some way, mm-hmm. then we can see that it isn't simply a literary maneuver to be citing earlier Greek literature, but rather you're situating yourself within the saga of Italy, whatever that means. And of course, we shouldn't forget that of Italy was Greek, and also the Etruscans took on a number of Greek myths, but also developed in their own way. By the time Aeneas comes on the scene, it's much more complicated than just Greek to Roman.
What do you think of the fact that Aeneas, and perhaps others too, but Aeneas is the most obvious, uses epic to talk about what I call war-to-war history? I don't know if that's a good term,
yeah.
but it seems to me quite distinct from the Greek tradition of epic, which lives much more in the mythological world, although I'm not saying it's divorced from their
from
identity
politics.
And history and politics at all. But Romans seem to me to be interested in talking about their history, hence Aeneas bringing it right up to now.
And the idea that history goes from the past and comes up to now, it is a continuous thing. I think you're right. And so this is actually an innovation on their part, is that they want to use the poetic form. It's the poetic form that they see as the best kind of way to preserve history, whatever that means. So the poets that I mentioned, they write tragedies. They also, some of them, write a specific form of type of play that the Romans invented, which was the historical stage play. So, for example, Aeneas writes the Sabinae, which is the rape of the Sabine women.
Yeah.
We don't really have anything of that. And so they evidently had a tradition of staging the past. And I think we could connect this to what we know of the rhetorical schools in Rome, which like to reimagine specific historical characters. Okay, now you pretend to be Cicero begging for his life, right? In their training, they put on masks, like this word persona, which means mask in its most literalized form. They like to play roles, but roles both from mythology and from history. And for them, it's not just this happened in the past, but this happened in the past and I can reimagine and reanimate it now. So Romans had a kind of, it seems, a sense of automatic transference in a way. That's why they call themselves this by the same name. So Brutus, the Brutus who helps expel the kings, influences the Brutus that kills Caesar. Like, you have the name and you have the face and you are, to some extent, your ancestor reborn. So this is, I think, a mechanism which connects both poetry and kind of politics in Rome, that they're interested in putting into a monumental form their politics and their history. So again, it might be Greek on the surface, but there's something deeply Roman to it.
That's really interesting. I do finally want to get onto what I've been leading up to all along, which is, how are Romans like Cicero reusing these fragments, or I don't know if reusing is a good term for it, how are they repositioning them?
Yeah.
Do you think they're cherry picking? Obviously he's using what's useful to him in his argument.
Right. I mean, I think it's worth stating that for him they weren't fragments.
Absolutely.
So Cicero mostly quotes poetry in his philosophical works. There are almost none, very few, in the speeches, which suggests that a public audience would not be interested in this. And so therefore it's a literary or a philosophical or part of elite discourse. So they do appear also in letters. So in the letters, they have a kind of communicative function. And in the philosophical works, they often do have a philosophical function. For example, again, coming back to dreams, but this is because Cicero is interested in them. He will talk about Aeneas's dream in the Academica because he's interested in sense data, right? So hallucinations and such, whether or not you can believe the images that you see. So in this context, whatever Cicero is doing, it is kind of a rationalizing of things which were just in their own literary or dramatic context in the first place. As you say, he's using it for a specific purpose, which you could say, well, Aeneas had philosophical material in the first place, and I think that's true, and certainly in the tragedies as well, but Cicero is definitely using them in his philosophy and adding that kind of extra analytical frame to it, emphasizing what is already latent in it.
So can you give us a specific example, like the dream of Iliad that you talked about before? Mm-hmm. Why does he quote that?
Right, and so this is quoted in the context of a work that tries to prove and disprove whether you can tell the future. And in fact, this is quite a difficult example because it's not clear whether Ilya's dream is telling the story of her rape, or whether it's foretelling it, that would be the context, right? But he gives it in a series of examples of pregnancies. So he is interconnecting them as examples of various foretellings of the future. In fact, it is in the context of his Stoic brother Quintus that is quoting it as an example of this is the kind of thing that has happened and will happen again.
It is pretty common in Roman literature, actually, for there to be dreams that pregnant women have that their son will be great or a problem for the world or whatever it is.
Exactly.
We've seen it a lot in our podcast with emperors. So Suetonius often tells of a dream that the mother or somebody else will have had that this person's going to be a snake or whatever.
Olympias.
Yes.
It's not about the narrative of here's the story of Rome. It's about here are some dreams that real and fictional people have had that connect to divination.
Right.
Itself tells you something about how philosophical discourse can work in this time that you can feel comfortable to cite literature.
As you're saying, it's in a very specific context of Cicero's, and I don't know if this is my snobbery or modern perspective, but I feel that Cicero's philosophy might have been what the ordinary people had less contact with.
Oh, certainly. He says sometimes in the works, now that we're alone, let's talk about this. One of the poets that I didn't mention, Lucilius, who's this satirist, he didn't originate satire, but he became, especially for Horace, the main satirist beforehand, also exists in a fragmentary state. With him, he has 1,400 fragments, actually, which is interesting. Cicero recites him the most in a work which has historical characters that Lucilius himself wrote about. So for Cicero, Lucilius was a documentary source of individuals that he wished that he would have known.
Yes, and Lucilius, when people learn about satire in particular, he's often cited as the satirist because he's from the Republican period who could actually speak out.
Right.
Although my feeling from the fragments we have, which is always unfair because we don't have whole poems, is that we don't see an awful lot of speaking out in those fragments. It's not obvious to me.
No, I mean, it's not.
He's not
hugely
naming names and having a go. And
right. It doesn't feel terribly political. It just feels like banter.
Satirists in the Empire sort of look back nostalgically and say, he could talk about contemporary politics. We have to button up and talk about the past.
Right. That seems to be a specific politicizing of Lucilius in the context of the Empire, which again tells you that we don't need to take everyone at face value when they, Horace or Juvenal, they have access to this, but they're remaking it in their own image as well.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a simplistic reading of it, but there seems to be a strong element of nostalgia and just a way of complaining about the present by wishing you had lived. They're basically, they're at least on the surface claiming they wish they'd lived in the Republic.
Right.
Everything was easier then for a certain type of freeborn man.
Yeah, this nostalgia for a time that you didn't live in is like very Roman.
It is. Other than Cicero, are there interesting uses of these fragmentary texts with other authors?
Yes. So one of Cicero's contemporaries, as I think I mentioned earlier, Varro. Varro writes a work about on the Latin language, and it's one of the times, in terms of fragments, good fragments, that is longer and maybe with a little bit of context, Cicero and Varro are the main ones. Looking at how Varro uses the Latin poets gives you some context about how different it is. It populates in your imagination a scholarly tradition, which actually we can see both Cicero and Varro studied under this individual called Lucius Aelius Stilo, called the Pen, right? Who, according to Cicero, was a Stoic, wrote speeches, and also was extremely interested in the Latin language, including various legal and religious texts. So when you look at Cicero and Varro together, you start to understand that the Romans themselves had a tradition of studying their own poetry that went beyond simply quoting it for ornamental sake. It demonstrates again, if we had more information, we would know more about Roman intellectual life that was interested in Latin poetry as artifact of Romanness and Roman language.
It's interesting that you put it like that, because I think that's a much more interesting way of looking at it than, I guess in the past I've thought of Varro as the quotations there being more akin to something you might find in a really big dictionary.
Yeah.
Do you think that's an unfair comparison?
No, I think that's a really good one. But then, like, how interesting is it what choices are made to put dictionaries together? I know this possibly might not be interesting for everyone, dictionaries, but it tells you that there's some kind of framework. Varro and Cicero aren't writing in a vacuum. They're drawing on a lot of things. Both of them quoting text so vigorously strongly suggests book use. Cicero sometimes is quoting from memory, you can tell, because he misquotes or paraphrases things like this, the same verses. But in a world where we don't have as much, you know, papyri come out of the ground in Egypt and at Herculaneum and at Vindolanda, but in a world where we don't have the evidence, looking at citations of poetic works actually, it makes you imagine books, which to me is amazing, right? So when you deal with fragments, you're forced to have an imagination because you don't have the whole thing there. But what you're trying to imagine is not precisely what is lost, but rather the kind of social and intellectual mechanisms that create the fragments. By the way, it might be worth stating that the two famous fragments of Sappho, 1 and 31, were made in the first century BCE and CE. And so there is something of a culture of quoting during this era that preserves not just Roman culture, but Greek culture too.
Yeah, so Sappho is much earlier than anything we've talked about, and yeah. She's a Greek poet, female poet.
Yeah, as far as we know, yeah.
And, you have questions about that?
I don't have questions, but, you know, I know, I do believe that she was a woman and she was a poet.
I don't want to lose one of our few female voices from antiquity.
No, absolutely not. No.
That's really interesting that's, I'm not sure I even knew that, or if I did, I'd forgotten that that's why we've got those particular amazing fragments, really important fragments for us. You talked earlier about persona and kind of taking on the mask to, in a way, recreate in a different context a myth from the past or a part of your own history. So that, I think, fairly directly leads me to my very last question, which is, if you could take on a persona of one of those authors, if you could have one of their texts, one of the texts we only have in fragmentary form, this is a very artificial question,
sure.
But what would you love to have? Or would it ruin your career if it weren't a fragment anymore?
Actually, that's a good question. Yes, it probably would. Even though there are a lot of weird little things that I would probably prefer to have, just to have a bit more diversity in terms of what our literary record is, I think it would be extremely instructive to have Ennius, the Annals, after all of this work trying to hand-wringing, does this fragment go here, does this fragment go there, it would just be such a great aha moment because we would just be definitely wrong about so many things. And it would help us situate a lot of what happens next, such as Virgil. I wish we could go into Cicero's library, for example. I would really be fascinated to see his quote-unquote bookshelves.
I like that idea. Rather than let's just have Ennius in front of us, let's instead be able to see what Cicero
the object looks like.
Take down from a shelf.
Well, because as books are material for us, these texts were material. I mean, in the Roman world, it has a much more kind of performative quality. That is, you're expecting someone to read it to you or for it to be performed to you. But these are literary objects, and that's what I would like to see about it.
That was Dr. Hannah Chulik-Baird, Assistant Professor of Classical Studies at Boston University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever you may listen. Please leave a rating and or a review. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Hannah is at @opietasanimi. I am at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. And the podcast is at Rome Podcast. Until the next episode, I'm Rhiannon Evans, and thanks for listening.